This is episode 8 on our whistle stop tour of the X-Files as we get ready for season 11. And today we're talking about Genderbender and Lazarus. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I'm delighted to be joined once again by Chris Knowles. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
We talked last time about your blog at The Secret Sun. Are you planning to cover season 11 when it comes around?
Absolutely. How could I not?
And what about the book that you co-authored? I know it got re-released. This is the complete X-Files book that I'm talking about. I don't know. Did you want to tell us a bit about that book, Chris?
I was originally going to be assigned the book. Frank Spotnitz was friends with Matt Hurwitz and felt more comfortable working with him. So Matt Hurwitz came on board, had never seen the series before, and sort of had to cram this, you know, he did a fantastic job, and the interview work he did was amazing. It came to be the classic deadline crunch, and Matt just felt a little overwhelmed, so they needed someone to come in who really knew the series inside and out and write that bulk of the work on the seasons. So I came in, and it was interesting because I had like hundreds of hours of interview material to sort through. They originally were going to give me, I think, 20,000 words, which is absurd. I mean, it's basically, you know, a long magazine article length. So I said, absolutely not. This has to be at least 40,000 words. I went through the interview material. I said, nobody cares about me. Nobody knows who I am. They want to hear what these people have to say. They want to hear what David Duchovny and Gillian Anderson and Chris Carter and, you know, Vince Gilligan and all these people have to say. What I tried to do, and I think I pulled it off, is bring in as much of the interview material as I possibly could and step back and make myself almost invisible as a voice to let these people tell their own story. Frank had actually emailed me and said, you know, you did a great job on this, which I was incredibly gratified to hear. But there was actually a problem because there was some issues with the copy editor and one of the editors involved in the project. And there's a lot of typographical errors. I mean, I never saw the galleys for the book, which is kind of unusual in with a project like that. When the book first came out, there was a lot of grumbling on fan boards and things like that about the typos and things like that. I had nothing to do with that. Even so, the book is mind-bogglingly gorgeous. The photography makes you melt. There's so many great behind the scenes candids and things like that. I mean, just as pure eye candy. It's an amazing book.
Yeah, and there was plenty of stuff in there, you know, little nuggets of information that I was unaware of. So yeah, it's well worth picking up, fans, if you haven't already. Okay, so we're in mid-season one on our Podwatch, and today we're talking first of all about Genderbender, which is episode 14 of the first season, written by Larry Barber and Paul Barber, and directed by Rob Bowman. And this, of course, is the episode in which a murderer is able to change genders, and Mulder and Scully's investigation leads them to a religious group known as the Kindred. Okay, Chris, so just general thoughts, first of all. What do you make of Genderbender as an episode?
Oh, I love Genderbender. There's some dodgy sexual politics in it, and there are some problems with the storyline, but it's very much of its time. People don't remember this. It's so long ago now, but there was still that lingering anxiety about AIDS that I think sort of informs the storyline. And there's so many proto-mythological elements here that sort of get a test drive. There were so many ideas that would become crucial to the mythology arc that they sort of start to toy with here. You know, aliens are shapeshifters. This is the first time we see that. There are aliens that want to break away from the colonization project. That's something that becomes very important in Colony and Endgame.
Yeah.
We learned that alien biology is toxic to humans. You know what I'm saying? So they were dipping their toes into the water here on ideas that would really be expanded upon and become so central to the overarching mythology. That's why I think this is a treat. I mean, I can't say it's a great hour of television. It's very well directed by Rob Bowman since his first episode. And again, you know, we were talking about before about the Jersey Devil and how there's absolutely no ratcheting up of the tension through the direction. You see here how important a good director is to these kind of stories, because if you read this script on paper, you would think, whatever. Rob Bowman, you know, he takes, I don't want to say a turd, but he takes, you know, what is not a great example of X-Files storytelling, you know, and polishes it as best he can, you know, if not into a diamond, then maybe, you know, cubic zirconium or something. I mean, it's, he does his best with it. He shows why he was such a crucial player, because his use of lighting, his use of shots that create all these almost disturbing kind of angles using the ceilings and using the architecture of a room, the way he can almost create these sort of impressionistic use of angles, almost to create like almost like a design on the screen. This is a guy with a very subtle and creative eye.
I had a similar note about Bowman, and one of the things I like in this episode is that the way it sort of sets up this almost a binary opposition between, you know, these hedonistic urban lifestyles and the restrained religious culture of the Kindred. One of the ways it's conveyed is through the contrast in the way the scenes are lit.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yes. you get the way the nightclub scenes are lit in very, very stark contrast to the scenes at the Kindred dwelling. Yeah, Bowman brought a lot to this, I think, especially the scenes in the subterranean sort of cavern as well. And his efforts are all the more impressive because apparently this was quite a difficult production because of the weather. And you can see, if you watch it on HD, you can see it's very apparent that it's raining very, very hard during this episode.
Actually, I think this was the episode that they had to delay production on because it got, you know, the conditions got so bad that they couldn't actually, you know, shuttle the equipment around because it literally became a swamp.
One common criticism I've heard of this episode is people who think that it overreaches at the end. Does that undercut the stuff that's come earlier? The fact that it's not just one shapeshifter, it's a whole sect?
That didn't bother me at all. It seemed a bit abrupt, and that was probably just a question of time, that they had so many scenes that they wanted to make sure it made the final cut, that, you know, it almost falls off a cliff at the end. That big reveal at the end probably would have been a lot more effective had they dropped in more hints along the way, rather than just like Deus Ex Machina.
I think it's quite abrupt, because I was watching this earlier today, and I'd forgotten that it's so late into the episode when the character of Michael appears, which is the guy played by Nicholas Lee, who's not Krycek.
Yeah, not Krycek.
Yeah.
Definitely not Krycek.
But it's quite late in the episode when he appears, and you go straight from that to sort of a climax, and then it's the end scene at the Kindred place. So, yeah, I agree. It shuttles through a few scenes quite quickly at the end.
Well, what you brought up before about how Rob Bowman uses lighting to demonstrate the contrast between these lifestyles, I think one of the, and this has to do with, again, television conventions of that era, I think if this story had been told today, I think it would have, you would have seen a lot. Okay, so you have these sort of wholesome Canadian extras dancing to techno music. Mark's no techno music,
yes.
By the way.
Yep.
And the most exotic thing about this nightclub is the geezer backdrop, you know. I think that if there had been a little bit more effort to show, you know, that these people were more decadent and they were more outrageous, that there was a little bit sense of the reality of, like, sort of outre nightclub, I think that that would have given the story a bit more punch. And, you know, it's interesting, too. I mean, Rob Bowman is from Kansas. I mean, he's a Midwestern conservative kind of guy who had a lot of problems with some of the stories that he had to direct because they offended his sensibilities. A great example is The Walk. He really didn't want the kid to be killed. And there were a lot of things that he didn't like to portray. He had a lot of problems with Terms of Endearment with Bruce Campbell, which is interesting that, you know, he's so artistic and so almost avant-garde in his storytelling, but at the same time, you know, he's of his place and of his time. So that is sort of that's sort of like a deficit to the storytelling here. I think that if you had a director who was a little bit more comfortable with showing the seamier side of life than Rob Bowman, that contrast would have been sharper. And of course, the irony being is that, okay, so these are just a bunch of ordinary people who are play acting in these nightclubs.
Yeah.
But the Kindred, who, you know, come across as being, you know, starchy and staunch and Amish and all these kind of things. I mean, they're freaks. I mean, they're absolutely freaks. So, I mean, we talked about before Howard Gordon and Axe Ganza putting all these interesting subtextual elements into the scripts. I think that if there had been maybe more I think what happened is that the Barbers created a script. Chris Carter wasn't happy with it. I mean, Chris Carter is basically running around like a madman this entire season doing everything. I mean, he's on set. You know, he's doing rewrites. He's doing his own scripts. I think that if there had been more time to sit down and go, okay, wait, we have an interesting idea here. Let's exploit this as fully as we possibly can, that this would have been a much better episode.
Yeah, I'll just end my contribution then by saying I think that one note I had was that this is an episode that's both, it's too lurid and it's also not lurid enough. I think that sort of meshes with what you said about Bowman, maybe his sensibilities. And obviously it's a bit of a left field choice for subject matter for the X-Files, but then it sort of pulls its punches a little bit at times.
And again, I mean, the thing that I really want to get across about this episode is that this is a test drive for mythology elements that we'll see exploited to much greater effect, starting with Colony and Endgame. Again, this is not an episode like, oh, you've never watched The X-Files? Hey, you got to watch Gender Bender, man. You know what I mean? This is like an episode that I think fans who are doing their rewatches who might skip this one really should pay a little closer attention to. They will see the seeds germinating of ideas that will become much more important later on in the series.
Okay, Chris, well, thanks for that. Let's turn our thoughts to Lazarus. Okay, so Lazarus is episode 15 of the first season, and this is written by Howard Gordon and Alex Ganza and directed by David Nutter. And this is the episode in which the consciousness of a bank robber transfers into Agent Jack Willis, who's a former mentor and partner of Scully's, after a shootout in a bank. Okay, Chris, so in this episode, you've got a marriage of supernatural elements with a brisk procedural investigation, certainly as the episode develops. How effectively does it do those things?
Oh, beautifully. I think this is a great episode. This is one of the standout episodes of the first season for me, and there's a number of different reasons. First of all, the original idea is that the spirit of the bank robber possessed Mulder. That was the original pitch. Network canned it. I think they were very wise to. That would have been a terrible episode.
Yeah.
That would have been Freaky Friday. And the idea, again, the first season doesn't always do it, you know, necessarily deftly, but trying to create backstory for these characters. And I think in this episode, in this particular instance, it's, you know, perfectly done. And again, Gordon and Ganza, being great writers, developed this idea that Scully is attracted to men of authority. That Scully, you know, naturally, because of her relationship with her father, and I don't know how much discussion there was in the writer's room about this, but this is an idea that Morgan and Wong first kind of air in Beyond the Sea and later elaborate on, you know, in an episode like Never Again. You know, what makes this episode so effective is that Scully, at this point, is a radical arch skeptic who believes absolutely nothing that Mulder is talking about and is faced with a man whom she loved. I mean, she had, you know, this intense romantic relationship with, being drawn into Mulder's world, you know, this sort of man of authority. I mean, this is, you know, a well-established FBI agent. And, you know, Gordon and Ganza take the ball and then they run with it. And it's interesting here because, you know, Scully's skepticism is her undoing at first. Because she's so unwilling to believe Mulder's theory, she ends up being abducted. And I guess this is sort of the first Scully abduction that we see. Later on, you know, her skepticism is her salvation. And this is Gordon and Ganza really playing up the contrasts here, you know, so beautifully because they're such great writers. So at first, she's so skeptical, she will absolutely not believe anything Mulder is saying, and that ends up with her being put into mortal danger. Mm. But at the end, the way this is staged and the way this is played, and it's beautifully shot, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Where she's like, "You're not Dupre. You know, you're Jack Willis. You know, remember we went to the Pine Barrens." I mean, just there are so many moments in this first season. Interestingly enough, a lot of them come from Gordon and Ganza, where, you know, Scully's power as a character really comes across in a way that a lot of fans at the time definitely did not appreciate, because everybody was like, "Oh, she's just a wet blanket. She's a stick in the mud. She's always just saying Mulder this, you know, Mulder that." But we see that this is a woman of like deep compassion, but also like deep passion. You know, the thing that I find throughout the series, and again, this is a subtext, this is not something that people notice, is that Scully is a woman who suppresses her own passions, who sublimates her own passions, you know, for men of authority. Her sense of, you know, I know a lot of people not really crazy about the later seasons, but her sense of betrayal that she feels and her sense of rebellion in the latest seasons, seems to a lot of people, "Oh, this is not Scully. This is not Scully's behavior." And it's like they're totally missing the subtext here, is that Scully is a woman who suppresses her own needs, who suppresses her own passions for the needs of men of authority, who eventually betray her in the worst possible way. So how else could she possibly act? I mean, I think that that is a very important part of her character that is overlooked by fans, because so much of the X-Files is subtext. So much of the X-Files is like looks, people's meaningful looks at each other. It's things that are not vocalized and they're not picked up on. I know that Kim Manners had said that, you know, this is a series you really have to pay attention to because so much of the communication is nonverbal. In this case, Gordon and Ganza are very expertly defining this character in ways, in shades and colors that were definitely not typical of the time. Maybe more today, you know, with long-form storytelling, decompressed storytelling. And, you know, another interesting thing, too, is that this is sort of like this through line of the second half of the season of reincarnation and survival of death. So it starts with Lazarus, then we have Young at Heart, then Miracle Man, then Born Again and Roland. And I think it sort of became a bit too, maybe a little monotonous in some ways, but this is the first expression of that idea that I think I by far the best of the, you know, the run there.
Yeah, you've hit on a lot of the things I was going to mention there. And one thing I would add is that when I was watching this earlier, I was paying attention to the work that David Nutter did. And there's a real fluidity to the camera work in this. And it means that he generates some very effective tension through this episode.
You know, vastly underrated episode. I've actually seen some people like really downgrade this episode, and I just I don't understand it. I think that this is a fantastic episode. The part of Jack Willis, I think, is beautifully played by Christopher Allport.
He attacks the role with a kind of sincerity, which is quite impressive, I thought.
Oh, he knocks it out of the park. You know, it's interesting, though, because there's a, we talked about how Gender Bender is of its time, you know. This episode is almost like Gordon and Ganza doing their Quentin Tarantino tribute, because, you know, Dupre and Lula are basically refugees from, you know, from a Quentin Tarantino movie. It's like True Romance, Natural Born Killers, California. There were a lot of these kind of movies at the time that were the anti-hero, the glorification of these Bonnie and Clyde kind of characters.
That's an interesting comparison with Tarantino. I think one thing that might have been different in a Tarantino script is that in this episode, the female bank robber betrays the male, whereas in Tarantino's work, the romance between the sort of the criminals is normally for keeps.
The X-Files is so zeitgeist. This is really an example of capturing, you know, not only Quentin Tarantino, but, you know, all his imitators. That this idea of this romantic notion of these really despicable characters being almost redeemed by their sense of romantic love towards each other, which we find out, of course, is not reciprocated.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
On Lula's part. Chuck Verrell, I think, is, you know, she also does a great job at portraying that character as well, because she has to play a character that are going to hate, and do so in a way that we sort of understand her motivations. I have some issues with some of the wardrobe choices, like that hat she's always on wearing.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You know, it's like, what? Hello? Yeah, I think this is a fantastic episode. And the way they build up the tension with Mulder's suspicions, you know, ratcheting it up. Another great Gordon and Ganza emotional beat here is just how crestfallen Mulder is by losing Scully for the first time. So it's like these are characters that are basically almost antagonistic for the first half of the, you know, the first season, right? I mean, these are characters that don't necessarily like each other. They seem sort of at odds. And of course, this is almost like classic sexual attraction trope here. You know, they start off being antagonistic. But and David Duchovny, he gets a lot of criticism for his acting. But I think he plays that scene beautifully. But also we get the sense that they dropped after the first season, and they really shouldn't have, because I think it's very crucial to the idea of point of view. And is this real, or is this just somebody's perception of reality? The way that Scully and Mulder's fellow agents in the FBI just think Mulder is ridiculous. Mm. He's a joke. I mean, it's just like that Mulder is an embarrassment to the FBI. He is a joke. And the way that was sort of shunted aside, I mean, you can sort of see it's like, oh, we already said that, you know, we don't need to repeat this. But I think so much of the X-Files, again, we talked about in Conduit, that whole idea of you think this is a UFO, but it just turns out to be a motorcycle gang. This is an idea that I think people overlook in the X-Files. Is this really happening, or is this just this person's perception of what's happening? And that's, you know, that ambiguity, you know, that studied, deliberate ambiguity that is woven throughout all these stories, you never really get the sense that what we're seeing is actually what we're seeing. It could just be somebody's perception of the reality, or somebody's framing of the reality, or somebody's deliberate distortion of the reality. That's something that's dropped when they overlook this whole centrality of this idea of the fact that Mulder is a joke.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the senior agent in this episode defends him slightly.
Yeah, Spooky's okay. He's okay in my book. It's interesting because, you know, in the eighth season, when they really said, okay, let's go back to what made the X-Files great in the first place. Let's try to reconstruct, you know, these building blocks that we had established in the early seasons. Now, when Skinner is trying to brief or Doggett in the case of Within Without, you know, it's like, oh, well, Mulder thinks this guy is psychic, and everybody just like laughs. Or you know, later on when Skinner's trying to say, oh, you know, these people were abducted and, you know, alien torture, and everybody's laughing. I mean, you can see them sort of revisit that idea. But I think that's a mistake to have dropped that idea, because as you get into those, say, the midway point of the season, say, the series, say, 3 to 6 or maybe 3 to 5, it's almost like it's being sold as there's too much of a sense of this is actually real, where there should have been more of that ambiguity being, you know, embroidered into the story.
You get similar scenes as late as The Field Where I Died and in Tempest Fugit. But yeah, you're right.
Tempest Fugit. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they shouldn't have minimized that aspect of things, though. I agree.
But I think that's what makes this first season, you know, unique, but I think more effective than people give it credit for.
Yeah.
Is that so? Okay, so, you know, you've got werewolves and you've got vampires and vampires in the next season. You've got werewolves and you've got shape-shifting sex aliens and, you know, you've got all these people coming back from the dead. Mulder thinks it's all real. Everyone else thinks he's a crazy asshole. You know what I mean? So there should have been more of that throughout the season to temper, you know, the conviction they had about, yeah, yes, this is real. This is happening.
We're out of time, Chris, but we'll wrap up our discussion on Lazarus there. Tomorrow on the X-Cast X-Files Podwatch, it's Young at Heart and EBE. I can't promise you any shape-shifting, sex-crazy aliens there, but two more interesting episodes to discuss.
Yeah, two great ones.
And in the meantime, listeners, find us on Twitter at @X_cast, and we'll be posting any news about the new series that comes up as and when we find it. Or find us on Facebook. If you search for X-Cast, you should find X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group. My thanks again to you, Chris, and until next time, listeners, trust no one.